Some winners and losers of the primary election were out today waving with their mahalo signs following primary election day. HPR's news director Bill Dorman joins us for a closer look at the primary election results and the races ahead for the general.
Yeah, you know, surprises, a relative thing, I guess, any time, but certainly in politics. And when they develop over time, it's maybe less of a shock. You look at the governor's race, for instance, and that was the numbers in the end, though, when they came out, not as close as some thought that they might be. So the final specific numbers for those keeping score at home, Governor Ige with a margin of 50.2%, 43.4% for Colleen Hanabuse on that. And traditions certainly part of this, as you said, in terms of the sign waving mahalos today. Also, Sunday, of course, the unity breakfast for the Democrats. When Yoshioka pulled the governor's side at the breakfast for a bit of a chat yesterday morning, he started by asking about the role of political action money, not just about the money, but the impact, the tone of the political ads.
Well, I mean, I think that the voters in Hawaii got tired of the negative campaigning. We were committed to telling our story and being positive about the things that we've accomplished, and I think more importantly, our vision for where we wanted to go. And I've always trusted in the people of Hawaii that, especially as it comes to elections, that they'll make the right decision.
Did you send them a message that, you know, you go negative and the voters just sort of turn off?
I mean, I do think, and as you know, there was just so much advertising down the last 2 or 3 weeks in the campaign, and so it does get into overload. I mean, yeah, I received a lot of the mail, you know, a lot of the different commercials running on TV. It does get overwhelming at times, and I just want to thank the people of Hawaii for being patient and working through. You know, voting is a very important function in a democracy. And I'm proud that in Hawaii we were able to get through this election season and really talk about issues that are important to the voters.
Isn't it ironic, though, you are the target of all the attack ads and your running mate now, Josh Green, was had all the positive things about you. Did you talk about that with Josh Green?
I haven't, and you know, we just talked briefly last night, and you know, I'm going to take a couple days off and get recharged, and we'll be coming back and integrating the campaigns, looking for the strengths of both of our campaigns and seeing how we can maximize the assets that we have.
You know, you run best when you think you're behind. Is that going to be the way?
Well, I've always believed that it adds an edge to the campaign to run from behind. It really energizes people, and as you know, we have a strong grassroots network of supporters, and they're excited and looking forward to November. And you know, as soon as we can lay out a plan, I know that we will be successful.
Of course, that unity breakfast bringing all the candidates together, the statewide races, and there were some interesting ones. As it turned out, the lieutenant governor's race, little drama, tightened a bit from the first printout through the evening, but Josh Green winding up with 30.2%, Jill Takuta 27.5%. The CD1, the Congressional District 1, Ed Case 38.7, Doug Chin 24.7, Donna Mercado Kim 17.6, the rest of the field in single digits. So it's interesting the way some of these races broke in the end in terms of numbers and sort of groupings, I guess.
Right, and particularly since some of the polls put, I think, Kim further out ahead of Chin, and he was able to pull out the numbers ahead of her.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, and so now Ed Case, presuming that he, you know, wins in November, heading for a congressional delegation, a Hawaii delegation in D.C., where as sort of a relative moderate compared to the rest of the delegation, you know, there's this continuum with the progressives and nationally in terms of the Democratic Party, the progressives on one end, the more of the centrists, you think of the old Democratic Leadership Committee folks on the other end. And it's interesting now Ed Case sort of moving off to one side. Not that that's going to be a huge factor, but it's going to be one of those interesting things to watch.
Right, and I think folks might recall when he was still at the legislature, and he made a run for Congress, and he, you know, I think was criticized for not waiting his turn.
Exactly. That's the famous phrase, wait your turn.
Right, right. And then he also had a big contingent of unions against him.
Mm-hmm.
So be curious to see how that all plays out.
Yeah, and now it's sort of the political landscape gets wiped a little bit because now everything has to move on back to, you know, thank goodness, the people's business, and now working together in terms of now, you know, yes, Governor Ige is going to be in for another 4 years and it's not going to be changed. And in terms of when the legislature comes back, it's going to be interesting on some of those dynamics as well.
And there are some folks that got the boot at
yes.
the state legislature.
Yes. Yeah. And interestingly enough, you know, you look at some of those races where incumbents lost. State Senate District 12 sticks out. Urban Honolulu, of course, Kaka'ako. Sharon Moriwaki beating Brickwood Galateria. And the margin here really surprised a lot of people, 53.5% to 33.6%. Interesting race.
Right. And I watched her kind of gain traction over at the HCDA meetings, the Hawaii Community Development Authority meetings, with the old Kaka'ako development and how that was progressing. And I think that kind of started out as her base where she got some traction. Because I know I think there was a contingent that was actually trying to oust Brickwood Galateria for some time, but it looks like they finally got a candidate who did that.
Well, and based on that idea of community involvement as well, it's sort of a theme across a few places. Interesting, other races, neighbor islands, you know, the mayoral races now down to runoffs. And interesting when you look at the role of term limits in these, both on Maui and Kauai, the incumbents were termed out, and Mike Victorine on Maui termed out on county council. Actually, now he's headed for a runoff with Ellie Cochran. And it'll be interesting, Alan Arakawa running for council, and Natalie Kama, he came in second in the primary. So they're going to be facing off in the general election, but that was a surprise to a lot of folks over there. Kauai looked for a while like Derek Kawakami might be heading for an outright win, that you know, if you get 50% plus one, that takes you through. But he and county council veteran Mel Raposo are going to be facing off in November, falling a little short of that 50%. Actually, in the end, just with those final numbers, yeah, 48.2% was what Kauakami wound up with.
So they're going to have to work a little bit harder for a few more months, right?
Well, and it's going to be interesting, you know, in any level of politics, in any area, the difference between the primaries and the general election is, you know, the classic that they say is that in the primaries, you know, you in a presidential sense, you appeal to your loyalists, and then you reach across the aisle and you try to broaden the message for the general election. Some of these runoffs are going to be interesting to see in terms of where the dialogue goes, where the issues are. I think Wayne was saying it's about 85 days or something to the general election. Voter turnout, just one other sort of point to mention. Overall, it's 38.6%, so still below 40%. Optimists would say, oh, but that's better than the record of 2016. It was even worse, 34.8%. But same-day registration, apparently not a huge factor in that, but that's just starting again. We'll see how the mail-in ballots go. Kauai
right.
starts out.
And when I was out at my precinct casting my vote, I always like to check in to see, how are things, any problems? And they said they did have some technical problems with the machinery, but then they were able to get it fixed. But they were happy because where I was, they said that there were more people coming in. So
downtown, I had more volunteers than voters when I went to the polls. But over time, and again, those mail-in ballots, starting in 2020, all ballots for Kauai are going to be mail-in. And if things work out, that's the plan.
The pilot, yeah.
2022.
All right. Okay, we'll see what happens during the general.
You bet. It'll be fun.
All right. Thanks a lot, Bill. That was HPR's news director, Bill Dorman, with the snapshot of Saturday's primary election. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up next, your quiz. In today's Backyard Quiz, we're asking you about a well-known landmark located at Pier 9 of Honolulu Harbor. In 1926, construction was completed on the Aloha Tower, making it the tallest structure in the state. All four sides were designed with a clock face, an observation balcony, and the huge words, Aloha. On top of telling time, the tower served as a lighthouse, but the secondary function was discontinued in the 1970s. Visitors and residents alike still delight in going up to the 10th floor observation deck and catching broad, sweeping views of Honolulu. During the 1994 tower renovation, warehouse buildings that were attached to three sides of the towers were removed. It now stands alone as a symbol of Honolulu's waterfront and has been a stalwart keeper of time for over nine decades. For today's quiz, can you tell us the exact date the Aloha Tower was placed on the National Register of Historic Places? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Aloha, I'm Kanila, Danny Kalekini.
And I'm Nicholas Kalekini.
And you're listening to The Conversation on Members-Supported Hawaii Public Radio.
We continue our election snapshot with the reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. Political and opinion editor Chad Blair joins us this morning. Hi, Chad. How are you doing?
Aloha. Could resist.
So you were at that Unity Breakfast meeting. Any other takeaways?
Well, they've been doing this every 2 years forever, it seems like. And I would say just about everybody that was anybody in the party was there. There were a few no-shows, but all the lead Democrats, elected or otherwise, were, you know, putting on a good face, saying we're going to come together. Let's not kid ourselves. There are divisions in this party. Tulsi Gabbard endorsed Colleen Hanabusa for governor. So did the top leaders in the State House and Senate, even campaign fundraise for her. So there's going to be some challenges going forward, some lingering bad feelings. Assuming Governor Ige is reelected and defeats Andrea Tupola in the general election, you know, these are people remember. You don't just forget about it when somebody's actively campaigning against you. And I think that will continue.
Yeah, I mean, I know in the past when we've covered those breakfast meetings, it's always interesting to see who doesn't show, you know, who's yeah, a sore loser.
But, speaking of losing, Colleen Hanabusa, I think, was actually quite graceful. She made a point of thanking the governor and his wife several times when she spoke at the podium. And although they appeared to be avoiding each other early on physically, they did embraced afterwards, had a big hug, and there was a standing ovation for that. The only other standing ovation during the breakfast was for Meiji Hirono, who, of course, is almost certain to be reelected to another term in the U.S. Senate.
Right. Anything else that struck you? I mean, I know, they've got to put their differences aside and work together.
You know, it's odd to see Ed Case back there up on the platform. Mm. It's been since 2006. You and Bill were talking about Case earlier, more moderate. He is not wholly welcomed, I think, in the Democratic Party. There are some still sore that he challenged Dan Akaka for the U.S. Senate all those years ago, and he lost several races since then, including trying to get back into Congress and a U.S. Senate run. But he did prevail. He prevailed, however, in a large, talented field, winning with just a plurality of the vote. Bill had the numbers earlier, you know, Doug Chin, Donna Kim, and others as well. So, but as Neil Abercrombie once said to me about Ed Case, Ed is Ed Case. He does what he's going to do. But I got the sense yesterday that it was like, Ed's back. voters clearly, show their differences. But had another candidate or two not been in that field of six or seven, one wonders if it might have been a closer race with Donna Kim or Doug Chin.
Right. In that breakfast meeting, you said everybody showed up, even those in the nonpartisan races, at city council. How are you looking
exactly
at that?
Well, it's we know that there's a rematch between Tommy Waters and Trevor Ozawa. That's the district that pretty much is from East Honolulu to Kapahulu, Waikiki. 41 votes separated them 4 years ago. I think it's accurate to say there's some bad blood there between Trevor Ozawa and Tommy Waters, and I think that's going to be pretty intense contest to watch going forward. Remember, there's only 9 members of the Honolulu City Council. There are factions. All you need is 5 to control the council. And then, of course, Mayor Caldwell has been active. He would love to have a council that's more favorable to him than the current one. He does. And Tommy Waters, he and Kurt Caldwell work together in the legislature. And Ozawa is aligned with Ernie Martin currently, the chair who's termed out.
Right, and Carol Fukunaga got in handily, and then we have a new face over on the North Shore.
Right. Heidi Tsuneyoshi, surprising a lot of people, a former aide to Ernie Martin, defeating Bobby Bunda, a much more well-known figure. He was a Senate president in the legislature for a while, but she broke through. And then there will be one other race, Brendan Elefante and Kelly Kitashima. That's the Pearl City Waipahu seat. They did not run in the primary because there's just 2 of them, but they'll be on the general ballot.
Right, so we'll see how this all plays out in the general. But thanks, Chad.
You're welcome, Catherine.
All right, that was political and opinion editor Chad Blair with today's reality check. To read the full story, lots of political stories, visit sybilbeat.org.
On August 25th in the Atherton studio, it's Kailua Moon, the duo of Danny Carvalho and Nani Edgar. Together, they bring their slack key, ukulele, singing, songwriting, and hula skills to traditional and contemporary Hawaiian music, folk, and pop. Reserve your seats today at hprtickets.org. Station members enjoy discounted pricing. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
As the dust settles over this weekend's election, we take a look at the results of the Office of Hawaiian Affairs. Joining us this morning is HPR's Ku'u'baby Hiraishi with the results.
Aloha, Catherine. Good morning.
Yeah, so how was it?
It looks like that original pool of about 24 candidates was shrunk down to 10 thanks to the primary election. So there are 5 seats open on the 9-member Board of Trustees for Office of Hawaiian Affairs. Right now, in the Oahu race, a big surprise, Kaleakaka, young blood, Kamehameha School employee, ended up at the top of that race over veteran government official Esther Kia'aina. Now, there was 5,000 votes between the two of them, but that was a surprise to many, and I think that idea of name recognition was really the name of the game in both races, not just the Oahu race. But in talking to Esther about this sort of that idea of name recognition and how it impacts her race and what she's going to do next, she really was thinking that she wants to bring in people who want to know what the issues are about and those who are participating in the race.
I think the best course of action for my campaign is to get our message out to those who participate.
Oh, very nice.
So I don't believe that the non-participation is actually going to impact any one of us. I think what we need to do is for those who decide they're going to participate, we all need to go after those voters, especially for those who voted for other candidates, and educate them about who is the best qualified candidate.
Now, the other issue that she kind of touched on was this idea of blank votes. I don't know if anybody was paying attention. more than, I think, 500,000 blank votes in the Ojo race this election. That's more than any other race. And this is nothing new to the Office of Hawaiian Affairs races. A lot of the candidates really struggle with trying to get their names out and trying to figure out how to make that blank vote an actual vote. So those will be some for Esther. She was saying she's going to just focus on folks that already voted or who already are engaged in the process. But for William Ayla, deputy director over at Department of Hawaiian Homelands, who's running for the at-large seat, he was saying that he wanted to find those are the cream of the crop that they want to go after for the general election. So in the at-large race, the top six vote getters are 15 candidates. The top six move on to the general and challenging incumbents. So there are three incumbents in this race. Is always the hardest thing to do, but the results proved to show that was the case. So the top three vote getters, again, Ojo trustees John Waihe the Fourth, Ahu Isa, and Rowena Akana, all winning at the top of that. But Bill Ayla got in. Also, Fe Hanohano, a former state legislator, made the cut. And then Brendan Kaleaina Lee, he's an up-and-coming civic club member and leader. So the six of them will go on into the general election. But a lot of getting the blank vote and also the name recognition has always been a tough thing for Ojo candidates. So back in 2013, the state legislature changed the rules to allow for primaries, because before that it was just a runoff in the general and hardly anybody would vote. And when they did look at the ballot, they didn't know who to vote for, so they just kind of picked whoever looked familiar. And so part of the response from seeing the results in this primary was there needs to be even more change, because even in the primary, people are still voting for name recognition, and there are still a number of blank votes. So spoke again to Esther Kia'aina about some of the changes that she thinks needs to be had.
There is a lot of concern in the community and among lawmakers that the system does not provide for equity among all candidates, given the fact that it's statewide. So I believe that there should be discussions with the Ojo trustees, the current Ojo trustees, the community, and of course the appropriate leaders, the legislature, on what changes might be necessary to further improve the system.
So she, that idea of sort of name recognition really played out in sort of a county by county. So if you look at the Ojo results by county, Fe Hanohano over on the Big Island, she took a lot more votes there. Hawaii Island voters really carried her to put her into the running for the general election. Same thing with Bill Ayla, who's on Oahu resident. A lot of Oahu voters had him on their ballot. But elsewhere, Kauai and Maui, they didn't really know these candidates because mm-hmm. they're not really familiar with them. So having that statewide campaign is really tough.
I'm just curious, did Esther think that the spread between her and the next candidate with Akaka did that surprise her at all? Because that's, some folks in their mind is it's kind of a legacy vote, right, for her father.
Yes. So it did surprise her at first, but when she thought about the idea of name recognition and, of course, the late Senator Daniel Akaka, it made sense to her. And I think I also heard from Anel Almaral, the president of the Association of Hawaiian Civic Clubs, who said the same thing. She heard from a lot of her friends and family saying that, I voted for her because she was, we thought that Senator Akaka was a great politician. And if she's got that same bloodline and the same sort of mannerisms and
the values,
political will and value, mm-hmm. then I should vote for her too.
And what do you make of the incumbents kind of hanging onto their seats, because there was a negative audit, the brouhaha over the lawsuits and the spending?
It was definitely a big surprise, especially since a lot of the candidates who were trying to challenge these incumbents were putting this campaign rhetoric about restoring trust and accountability. So to see the three trustees, incumbents, come out on top was sort of a nod in the direction of, okay, maybe Ojo's doing all right, or OHA's doing fine. We don't need to change it up. And that's what I kind of took away from seeing them at the top.
Yeah, all very interesting. Yes. So we'll see what happens in the general.
Yes.
All right, Kuve Hirishi, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That was our reporter, Kuve Hirishi, with the snapshot of the Office of Hawaiian Affairs. I'm Catherine Cruz, and this is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Scheidler Family Foundation in support of the Honolulu Museum of Art, presenting the exhibition Making Waves, Water-Inspired Art by Contemporary Female Artists, through March 31st. HonoluluMuseum.org.
Ever wonder if research is done right here in the islands that impacts the health of all of us? I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak. Join me today on The Body Show. We'll hear more about some exciting new projects, from emergency room visits, gout, concussions, allergies, all being studied right now. That's today at 6:30 on The Body Show.
The Congress shall have the power to declare war, grant letters of marque and reprisal, and make rules concerning captures on land and water. That is the text of Article 1, Section 8, Clause 11 of the U.S. Constitution. The Constitution also names the President of the United States as Commander and Chief of the nation's armed forces, but it conspicuously does not grant him the power to declare war. Presidents throughout history have pushed the limits of executive power, from Thomas Jefferson and the Barbary Pirates to more recent actions in Libya, Iraq, and Syria under Presidents Obama and Trump. But a bipartisan resolution in Congress aims to change that. It was co-sponsored by Hawaii Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard and would classify the use of military force without congressional approval as an impeachable offense. Ann Wright is a former U.S. Army officer and diplomat with the State Department. She's also president of the Hawaii chapter of Veterans for Peace, which has endorsed the resolution. She spoke about it with The Conversation's Ryan Finnerty.
Well, indeed, it's an issue that all presidents and Congresses have attempted to deal with, although from the presidential aspect, they don't want any curtailment of their powers. And in fact, we've seen in both the Democratic and Republican presidents that they tend to do what they want to without any objection. Well, I shouldn't say objection, but without Congress really holding their feet to the fire. From Clinton to Bush to Obama, now Trump, you have use of military force without authorization, or a very general authorization, which gives such sweeping powers that, you know, essentially Congress gave away the farm back in 2001. And subsequent presidents have all said that all military operations fall under the global war on terror. And so they just slip in anything they want to do under that. So this new resolution that's coming up in Congress about impeachment, if there's no congressional authorization, I don't think will hold water at all. I don't think it'll pass the Congress. And even if it did, I don't think the president would really feel too fearful about not abiding by it.
An argument has been made, Anne, that one of the reasons that so much authority to use military force has been ceded by the Congress was that during the Cold War, a decision had to be made in minutes because of mutually assured destruction and the threat from intercontinental ballistic missiles, and that there simply wasn't time with that threat to wait for a declaration of war or for a debate in Congress, and that a decision needed to be made very quickly. Do you have an opinion on that argument, and do you think it's still relevant in the current climate?
No, I do not think it's relevant in this current climate. We are not we haven't faced that type of decision making. The use of military force that we've seen from Clinton all the way through Bush, through Trump, has been decisions that are being made over a period of time where the immediate need to use, for example, a nuclear weapon just never has been there. And so, but the presidents all like to have this authority that they can do anything they want to any time, even though it's just it's not immediately necessary.
The resolution that's currently that was put forth by members of the House of Representatives, including Hawaii Representative Tulsi Gabbard, one of the things that it does is it basically says that the use of military force without congressional approval would qualify as a high crime or misdemeanor and thus make it a impeachable offense. And it appears to set a pretty wide standard for what's considered military force. It says if the United States becomes a co-belligerent or systematically or substantially supplies war materials, troops, trainers, advisors, or financial support to another belligerent, that's considered military action. Do you think that's too broad of a standard? Does that constrain the executive too much?
Well, I personally like the resolution. I think the presidents have had unbridled power for way too long, and we've seen what it's gotten us into, the huge amount of money that we have spent on wars over the last 25 years, and I think it's time it comes to an end. So I personally kind of like that broad definition of it. Of course, all of the presidents would be impeachable under that because they certainly have provided material assistance to belligerents, to virtually every one of those categories that they've mentioned. And for that reason, I think that's why the Congress, or the few Congress members that generated this, put it all in there, because there's been such egregious actions by the presidents. I mean, right now, the United States of America probably is supporting 50 different belligerent groups around the world. We have military trainers in 100 and some odd countries. The level of U.S. military involvement in countries around the world is unprecedented. And when we talk about other countries having military operations in third countries, well, it's chump change compared to what the United States is doing all over the world. So for the Congress people to go ahead and include all of this range of military activities, I personally like it, but I think every president that we've had for the last five presidents would be impeached under it, which might not have been a bad idea.
So you served in the U.S. Army as an officer, a senior officer, and then you went on to serve in the State Department and embassies around the world, Central Asia, Africa, South America, and some of them were in conflict zones. In your experience, what effect does the president's ability to have kind of unencumbered use of the military have on U.S. foreign policy, whether good or bad?
Well, it certainly has gotten us involved in things that I personally disagreed with. In fact, I resigned from the State Department over exactly that President Bush made the decision to invade and occupy Iraq without the authorization of the U.N. Security Council, and he did it unilaterally. So I think that we have had just a plethora of unnecessary wars, and there are more on the horizon. That when we look at what happened in Iraq, we look what is happening in Syria right now, and that started under the Obama administration. We look at what's been going on in Libya, and in Yemen, of course, where poor little Yemen is just beaten to its knees with a huge number of civilian casualties as the United States supports the Saudi massive bombing of areas of Yemen. So I think the unbridled use of military power has really gotten the United States into horrible situation where the most countries of the world think that we are we're a renegade force, that we just invade and occupy anytime we want to, which is true.
Now, as you mentioned earlier, I mean, this would just open up the use of military force without authorization as an impeachable offense. It doesn't mean that the House of Representatives would, in any administration, would choose to bring up articles of impeachment. But you could also foresee a situation where it could be used to hamstring a president, to constrain a president based on politics. And one example I'm thinking of is that the U.S. military is used very heavily for humanitarian assistance and disaster relief. Now, that's really the primary means that by which the U.S. government does humanitarian assistance abroad. A lot of that has been ceded from by the State Department. Do you think that's a concern, that that it opens up some of these traditionally nonpartisan uses of the military to political interference?
Well, I think if there is a natural disaster, an emergency where U.S. military forces are needed to help another country deal with it, for example, like the huge tsunamis that were in Aceh or other things like that, I don't think the president would have any trouble at all getting the agreement of the U.S. Congress for the use of forces for reasons like that. I think the purpose of that resolution is just to remind the president, yeah, just come to us, just get our approval and things like that. I don't think there'd be any problem. But things such as the invasion and occupation of another country, probably there should be a robust debate in the Congress on whether or not the United States ought to be invading and occupying other countries.
All right. Anne Wright, thank you so much for your time today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
That was Anne Wright, former American diplomat and Army officer, speaking about House Resolution 922, which would make it an impeachable offense for a president to use military force without congressional authorization. It's a bipartisan measure co-sponsored by Hawaii's Tulsi Gabbard and North Carolina Republican Walter Jones. You can find a link to it on the conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org. We now switch gears and take a look to the skies with HPR's Dave Lawrence.
Stargazer Time, our weekly look into the massive universe around our tiny planet. We also find out what's happening in our dark island skies. Christopher Phillips joins us, tapping into his expertise now. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do you have this week?
Hey, Dave. It's good to be back. So this week, stargazers, look out for Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn in the western and southerly skies after sunset. The moon this week is approaching its first quarter phase, and whilst it may become brighter towards week's end, conditions will still be great for stargazing.
Now, there is a facility in the Aloha State that has a sister facility somewhere that I understand just got some funding approved to make repairs after a storm affected their operations.
It certainly did. The Very Long Baseline Array, or VLBA, atop Mauna Kea is but one of a network of 10 dishes that spans the U.S. from Hawaii all the way to the Virgin Islands. Last year, during Hurricane Maria, the dish in the Virgin Islands was hit hard and suffered enough damage to put it out of commission. Last week, a disaster relief bill passed by Congress included within it $2 million to bring the VLBA station back online.
Now, as I recall, this is an interferometer. Explain exactly what that is for folks.
Well, an interferometer is usually a network of smaller telescopes that combine their signal in order to mimic the effect of having a much larger telescope. In the case of the VLBA, each dish is about 25 meters across, and on their own, they're pretty good telescopes. However, when the signal is combined from each of the 10 dishes, it becomes formidable.
And what's the kind of stuff you use a tool like this for exactly? Because these are always a real fascination to me when you link all these telescopes up and it gives you more power. Well, what are they looking for with something like this.
It's very cool indeed. And the VLBA does a bunch of awesome science, including space weather prediction, mapping the large-scale structure of the universe, and also doing precision astrometry, which is measuring accurately the positions and distances of objects in space.
And Christopher, explain how these devices are measuring something entirely different that people might be surprised about.
There is indeed. The VLBA also monitors continental drift here on the Earth. Because the dishes are spread out over such a wide area of the Earth, the signals they collect can tell us all sorts of cool things about our own planet, including how the continents are moving.
Well, it's fascinating stuff, and great to be hearing about it with you. It's Christopher Phillips and another Stargazer. Thank you so much.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week. And you can find Stargazer on demand online at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Stargazer comes from Urgent Care Hawaii. Walk-in clinics in Pearl City, Kailua, Kapolei, and Waikiki, providing employers with occupational medicine and workers' compensation services. AmazingUrgentCare.com.
Earlier in the show, we explored the history of the iconic Aloha Tower at Pier 9. Officially opened on September 11, 1926, designers utilized the style of Hawaiian Gothic architecture, a mix of Art Deco elements and traditional Gothic revival. The lighthouse beacon sitting atop the tower could be seen by mariners up to 16 miles away. The clock itself sits between the 10th floor observation deck and the 9th floor office space. At the time, it was the largest timepiece in all of Hawaii and one of the largest in the United States, weighing it at 7 tons. Now, that clock can be seen from anywhere around Honolulu Harbor and continues to be weight-driven with its pendulum keeping accurate time. For today's quiz, we wanted to know the exact date that Aloha Tower was listed on the National Register of Historic Places. And the answer? May 13th, 1976. But we stumped you listeners out there on another one. But that was today's quiz. And if you have an idea for one, send it to Hawaii to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Hi, I'm Craig Jenkins, a storyteller from London, England. You're tuned into Hawaii Public Radio. Join the conversation on Twitter. Talk back to your radio at HI Conversation.
Hawaii saw its first hurricane of the season. Hurricane Hector skirted us by last week, but the focus on preparedness drew our attention to a new app that was born out of two storms in the Atlantic, Harvey and Irma. Adam Huminski and Brian Helinski wanted to create something to help link evacuees and hosts during a national disaster. They flagged the new app that they created to us last week as Hawaii watched that first hurricane of the season approach.
Harmony app is a new app that we just developed this year and is recently available on iOS and Android devices. And pretty simply put, the app was developed to help connect people who have extra space with people who need a safe place to go during emergency and evacuation events. So the idea came to us last year when we saw all of those hurricanes happening one after each other. So with Harvey and then Irma and then Maria. For us, in particular with Irma, we both live in the Carolinas, and we saw firsthand the effect of 7 million people trying to be evacuated from Florida from this major hurricane that was headed straight to the area. And it was, you know, very difficult for these people to essentially pick up their lives and move on and try to find a safe place to go. So when we saw all of these events occurring, it came to Adam. He actually reached out to me and said, you know, I'd really like to try and help somebody. and offer them a place to go, because even in the Carolinas, we saw a pretty significant portion of 7 million people coming in our direction. So Adam was struggling in a sense that he had some space. He was really willing to help a family that may be in need and just need a place to stay for a few days while they were being evacuated from Florida. And unfortunately, there just wasn't an easy way to do that, or a centralized community of people that could be connected for, you know, somebody that has the space and then somebody that needs a safe place to go. So we got together and kind of put our minds together and came up with this idea for Harmony, and to develop this application where it would be an easy way to try and connect these people during these difficult times. So we started developing the app early this year, and we wanted to, like I said, make it as easy as possible, in a sense where when people come and download our Harmony app, that it's easy to either you're coming because you need a place to go, or you have a place that you're willing to offer to somebody else. So for a new user that downloads our app, you'll be greeted by our main dashboard, and you have these two large options: you need a place or you have a place. And then from there, if you need a place to go, you can simply go into the application and you can search by a map or a list of people that are close to your proximity, or if you have an area in mind where you might be looking to try and evacuate and find a safe place to go, you can search by location. And you can also create user preferences and just kind of input a little bit about who you are, whether you're an individual or a family perhaps that might have 4 members or 6 members in your family, if you have any pets or special requirements or things that you just would be in need of. You can put all these preferences in and then be connected with somebody who on the flip side has a place to go.
And these are for short stays, right?
Correct. Yeah, it's essentially to help people bridge the gap, essentially, from when they need to get up and go to find a place just to go for a short period of time. Our app only allows stays up to 7 days.
Oh, so just
a
week.
After that, it's up to that person. You know, obviously, they're going to have to see and evaluate what may have happened in their area and be connected with somebody such as FEMA if there's a need for a little more long-term solution. But for the short term of just trying to find a safe place to go on short notice is why we developed the Harmony app. For somebody that may have a vacation rental, for somebody that may not have a vacation rental, but maybe they have in an area where there's basements, or they have an extra bedroom, or just an area within their home, it can be used in so many different ways. If there's a safe place that you can offer somebody to go, then you can use Harmony to connect with people who need that safe place.
So at this point, it's a free app?
Yes. The app is free to download, and it's free to use. There's no fees for anybody to come in and use the app. As a security feature, we do have a credit card authorization similar to what you would see at a hotel, where your credit card would just have a $100 hold on the card. But we never actually collect any of those funds, and it simply comes down to the app it's free to use, but we just utilize the authorization kind of as an added security feature for the app.
So how does that work as far as like payment of any kind of money between the two parties?
There is none. This is all done on goodwill. It's essentially people that really truly just want to help people. It's not for somebody that's looking to make any kind of monetary incentive off of somebody's bad fortune, I guess. We wanted to create this for, you know, people that truly need help, people that truly want to help them, and not make it into a profitable type thing.
I see. And then have you reached out to any of the emergency management agencies?
We have. Being a startup, we've had to rely on introductions made through various channels, and then obviously have to go through just the basic submission process to try and get connected with the emergency management teams. You know, we've had some discussion with some of the large cities throughout Florida, and have kind of targeted our app launch through the Southeast United States and are hoping to expand. We're just trying to do our best to connect those people when they have a difficult time trying to find a place to go, with people that are truly willing to help, you know, with the tropical storms, with the fires that are occurring in California. Anytime where somebody has a need for temporary shelter during an emergency, you know, it would be great for anybody, including your listeners, just to sign up and lend a hand if they're able to do that. You know, it's easy to do. We created the app to be kind of more of a proactive solution where people can sign up today. We hope it's an app that many people sign up for, but truly never have to use. So when an event does occur, it's easy to go in and you can set your preferences and you can tell people that you need shelter and you can enter your shelters in advance and easily turn them on and off. So if you want to enter your space and keep it turned off, you can do so, and then you can only turn it on when there's an event, such as what you guys saw with the volcanoes and things like that.
That was Brian Helinski, one of two developers of the app Harmony. It was designed to help match up those who may have room in their home with victims of a disaster for free short stays. For links and more info, check our webpage at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from Mattson, in appreciation of HPR's local public affairs programming. Since 1882, working to support Hawaii's economy and communities. Mattson.com.
New music from an old soul. That's Oahu-born soul singer and guitarist Nick Kurosawa. There'll be nothing between you and this bright young talent in HPR's Atherton Studio on Saturday the 18th. Reserve your seats today at hprtickets.org. Station members enjoy discounted pricing. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
Folks say that you...
We do have to go, but up tomorrow, why the FBI is pushing a new initiative to hire interpreters and translators. And the city wants feedback on a blueprint for the future development in the urban core. Got feedback on something you heard on our show? Call our talkback line and leave us your comments. Here's that number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, post your comments on Facebook at The Conversation, or tweet us at HI Conversation. We'll have links to more information about guests and topics. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.